Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, December 12th, 2024, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. Our focus is primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. DPS asks Mays for legal opinion to clear the way for it to expand rapid DNA testing in AZ. GOP lawmakers call on AZ Attorney General to probe Pima Recorder over 2024 election. Recreational marijuana sales stabilize in October following sharp September drop. Judge tosses GOP lawsuit to purge 1.27 million Arizona voters. And let's get started. Our first story, DPS asks Mays for legal opinion to clear the way for it to expand rapid DNA testing in AZ. By Jared McDonald Devoy, December 10, 2024. The Arizona Department of Public Safety is asking Attorney General Chris Mays to advise it on the use of a new DNA testing technology that has critics concerned about privacy and misuse, but that law enforcement sees as a boon to solving cold cases. Rapid DNA devices are able to test samples of DNA in 90 minutes, shortcutting a process that can take weeks or months in a standard laboratory setting. Law enforcement says it's a solution to overworked crime labs with backlogs, and it can create a statewide and national database more quickly. But critics argue that it could lead to abuse, to test without consent, or lead to the mishandling of DNA, which could kill cases before they begin. In a letter sent to Mays in November requesting a legal opinion, DPS said it is seeking approval from the FBI to use the technology for the analysis of qualified arrestee DNA database samples at booking station collection sites. In order to obtain approval from the FBI, DPS has to get a legal assessment of existing Arizona law on if they have the authority to administer such a program in the booking process. Arizona has been a leader in the use of technology going back as far as 2014, when a statewide program was first established to use the technology. Now, DPS is seeking approval to work with the FBI to allow for DNA to be analyzed with rapid DNA machines when a person is booked into jail, and for it to be entered into the Combined DNA Index System, or CODIS, the National DNA Database. The state of Arizona already allows for the collection of DNA from individuals arrested for qualifying offenses, DPS said in a statement to the Mirror. This program would reduce the turnaround time for these samples to be analyzed and entered in CODIS. Each interested state is required to submit a proposal to the FBI to ensure each requirement in the National Rapid DNA Booking Operational Procedures Manual is met prior to entering into an agreement with the FBI to operate a rapid DNA booking program. Louisiana was the first state in the country to receive approval from the FBI in 2022, followed later by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Groups like the American Civil Liberties Union have voiced concern over the program and the use of the technology. The technology has been championed by former Washington State Representative David Reichert, who has lobbied for the FBI partnership and for the technology to be used in other countries. While the technology has helped solve cold cases and aided in identifying the remains of victims of devastating natural disasters, it has also faced criticism for unreliability and some instances where errors or fraud in the handling of DNA have led to thousands of cases being reviewed. DPS says that the state has taken steps to remedy these concerns by ensuring that samples used for rapid DNA cannot be destroyed in the process and must be confirmed by an accredited crime lab. A wide variety of case types have been processed in our program, including residential and commercial burglary, aggravated assault, sexual assault, and homicides, DPS said in a statement. In addition, the program had led to victim identifications in vehicular accidents, as well as excluding individuals from criminal investigations. If approved, DNA tested in the system will be automatically searched against a selected subset of unsolved forensic cases, and the booking station would be notified if the DNA matched any results. DPS said that only members of the Law Enforcement Rapid DNA Program can access the data and that it will only be transmitted through secure law enforcement networks. Rapid DNA testing has also been used at the southern border, often on asylum seekers, which has seen similar concerns surrounding privacy that have been echoed by other privacy-forward organizations. And that concludes this first story. DPS asks Mays for legal opinion to clear the way for it to expand rapid DNA testing in AZ. We have a story that just broke as we were recording. Commission gives Hobbs five options for new AZ Supreme Court Justice by Caitlin Sievers, December 10, 2024. Governor Katie Hobbs will pick Arizona's newest Supreme Court Justice from five nominees, including two judges and three attorneys, recommended to her by a judicial screening panel. The new justice will replace Republican Robert Brutinel, who retired at the end of October after 14 years on the high court and 28 as a judge. Hobbs will be the first Democrat in more than 15 years to appoint a justice to Arizona's high court. Brutinel was appointed in 2010 by then-Governor Jan Brewer, a Republican. Supreme Court Justice Scott Bales, the last judge appointed by a Democrat, was placed on the court in 2005 by then-Governor Janet Napolitano. He retired in 2019. The Nonpartisan Commission on Appellate Court Appointments on Monday interviewed eight semifinalists out of 17 total applicants, ultimately recommending five of them to the governor. Arizona law requires the commission to recommend at least three candidates for appointment, with no more than 60% of them from the same political party as the governor. On Monday, the commission members chose to recommend three Democrats and two independents. They are Maria Elena Cruz, a Yuma County Democrat who has been a judge since 2005, and on the Arizona Court of Appeals since 2017. She previously worked as a Yuma County Superior Court judge and for the Yuma and Pima County Attorney's Offices. Nicole Davis, a Maricopa County Independent, who is the Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Arizona Department of Economic Security. She was previously Deputy General Counsel for Governor Janet Napolitano. Andrew Jacobs, a Maricopa County Democrat, who was appointed to the Arizona Court of Appeals in March 2023. Prior to that, he was a partner at Arizona law firm Snell and Wilmer for 20 years. Regina Nassen, a Pima County Independent and Principal Assistant Attorney for Tucson. She previously held various positions in the Pima County Attorney's Office. Alexander Samuels, a Maricopa County Democrat and Deputy Solicitor General for the Arizona Attorney General's Office. He previously held various positions with the United States Attorney's Office. Hobbs has 60 days to appoint a new Supreme Court Justice. Christian Slater, a spokesman for Hobbs' office, told the Arizona Mirror that he didn't have any information to share about the timing of Hobbs' interviews with the candidates or a more specific idea of when the appointment would take place, other than within the 60-day limit. And that concludes this story. Commission gives Hobbs 5 options for new AZ Supreme Court justice. Our next story, GOP lawmakers call on AZ Attorney General to probe Pima Recorder over 2024 election. Representative Rachel Jones claims there was obviously a very well-run plan to rig the election after a Democrat won a seat in her district. By Jim Nitzel of the Tucson Sentinel, December 9, 2024. Two Republican state lawmakers have asked Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays to open an investigation into Pima County Recorder Gabriela Cesaris-Kelly's handling of the 2024 election and related issues. Representative Rachel Jones and Representative Teresa Martinez, Republicans who both represent districts that include parts of Pima and Pinal counties, asked Mays to look into the recorder's office decision to close down an online portal that allowed voters to request early ballots, as well as unfounded allegations on social media that the recorder's office improperly handled early ballots that were undeliverable by the U.S. Post Service because the voters had moved. The Tucson Sentinel's reporting revealed that undeliverable ballots are destroyed by the USPS and not returned to election officials. The GOP legislators also asked Mays to investigate whether the recorder's office had improperly registered felons who were ineligible to vote when they had a voter registration drive in Pima County Jail. The lawmakers did not file the complaint under the authority of SB 1487, the informal name of a statute which obligates the Attorney General to investigate whether an ordinance is in violation of state law. And Martinez said she was skeptical that Mays, an elected Democrat, would pursue an investigation. "My faith in Chris Mays is not that high," Martinez said. She added that she and Jones would be filing a public records request this week to further examine communications regarding the issues they raised in their letter. Recorder's Office spokesperson Michael Chulson said Cesaris-Kelly did not wish to comment on lawmakers' call for an investigation. Chief Deputy Recorder Marion Chuban told the Sentinel in October that she made the decision to shut down the portal on Saturday, October 19th, about a week before the October 25th deadline to request a ballot, and cancel about 6,000 requests for early ballots. She said the portal was closed down because it became overwhelmed with requests for early ballots, and the recorder's staff would not have had time to fulfill them. Many of the requests were from voters who had already requested ballots but had not received them through the mail because of a delay in sending ballots to voters. All of the affected voters who had not submitted duplicate requests were sent an email notifying them that their request had been canceled and advising them to instead call the office to request a ballot. Cesaris-Kelly said voters had multiple ways to cast early ballots after the online portal closed, including calling her office to request one or visiting one of the early voting sites that were set up around town. They also had the option of voting on Election Day. "I am confident that most of the voters who requested a ballot using our online form either received their already queued ballots, voted early in person, updated their addresses online, or successfully requested a mail ballot," Cesaris-Kelly said in a report before she answered questions regarding the incident at a November 19th Board of Supervisors meeting. She said that many requests to the office were duplicates or from Pima County residents who were not eligible to vote for various reasons. Of the 20,465 early ballot requests that were processed by her office before the online portal was closed, 12,645 of them were invalid requests because those requesting ballots had already voted, had made a duplicate request, were not registered to vote, or had another problem, such as an outdated address, according to Cesaris-Kelly. Cesaris Kelly told supervisors that the office was preparing a post-election review and planned to improve the portal so that in future elections, it would be easier to cross-reference whether a voter was making a duplicate request. Supervisors voted against a motion to have Mays or a county attorney outside of Pima County investigate the closing of the portal, with only Republican Steve Christie supporting it. Martinez said Cesaris Kelly's explanation suggested the Democratic recorder was ill-equipped to do the job of handling early ballot requests. Essentially, what she is saying is that she cannot do her job because she is overwhelmed, even though she has the ability to hire temporary staff and have them work overtime, Martinez told the Sentinel. The email to voters, Martinez added, was akin to saying, "Come back later when we have our shit together." This is a direct quote. She likened it to a long line at a store. You don't tell those people, "I'm sorry, put your stuff back. Come back when we can handle the line." That doesn't happen, Martinez says. It sounds like it's just Christmas. Christmas comes every year at the exact same time, and retailers know that they have to either bulk up staff to make sure to hire temporary staff, make sure everything is ready to go so that they can handle the onslaught of Christmas shoppers that are going to come into their store, and that's what the Pima County Recorder should have done. To my knowledge, no other county recorder in the state of Arizona shut down the portal. Unfounded Twitter allegations. Jones and Martinez also asked Mays to look into how Cesaris Kelly handled mailed ballots that were undeliverable because the voter had moved. By law, the U.S. Postal Service cannot forward a ballot to a new address. Trulson told the Sentinel that in Pima County, the USPS destroys undeliverable ballots and informs the recorder's office about it so they can track the ballot's status. Neither Arizona law nor the state's election procedure manual address how undeliverable ballots should be handled, according to J.P. Martin, a spokesperson for the Arizona Secretary of State's office. Because it's not laid out in state law, counties have the discretion to establish their own protocols, Martin said in an email. The handling of undeliverable early ballots in Arizona varies, Martin said. While some county recorders collaborate with the USPS to have undeliverable ballots returned for processing and destruction per records retention schedules, others may allow the USPS to destroy undeliverable ballots and then notify the recorder's office. In October, Jones amplified unfounded claims that election officials were trying to rig the election through the use of early ballots after a former Pima County resident who had recently moved to another state said on Twitter, the social media site that now uses X for a logo, that his wife's early ballot had been returned to the recorder's office and was awaiting signature verification. The recorder's office allows voters to track their early ballots via its website and has categorized the ballot as being, quote, in the process of verifying your signature, followed by a message that advised, please contact our office at 520-724-4309 or 520-724-4330 regarding your signature. Cesaris Kelly declined to discuss the matter with the press, but on Twitter she acknowledged that the office had erred in categorizing the ballots that the USPS had been unable to forward. Cesaris Kelly tweeted on October 22nd that the website's message was, quote, misleading and alarming. We agree, she wrote. We made a mistake. The language was changed to show just the message, please contact our office at 520-724-4330. Cesaris Kelly said instead of crafting better language for the message, she had to spend time tweeting about this non-story because conspiracy theorists are fishing for outrage. We're working hard to keep 650,000-plus voters informed about their most fundamental rights as Americans. We're following the law and providing info as a courtesy, not a statutory obligation. Jones tweeted on October 20th that she believed the episode was evidence of a scheme that involved workers at both the USPS and the Pima County Recorder's Office using vote-by-mail ballots to rig the election. Apparently, they are using absentee ballots that belong to voters who have moved, Jones wrote. There is obviously a very well-run plan to have someone at the post office notify someone at the recorder's office that the change of address has occurred and the ballot is available to immediately be illegally cast. Jones, who did not respond to a request for comment from the Tucson Sentinel, has previously made numerous unfounded allegations that Arizona elections are rigged to justify various legislative proposals to restrict voting rights. While in a pursuit of a second term in heavily Republican Legislative District 17 in last month's election, Jones trailed Democrat Kevin Vogt, who received 2,365 votes more than she did in the race for two seats. Jones' seatmate, Republican Representative Cory Maguire, failed in his bid for re-election, losing to Vogt by 5,081 votes. Maguire suggested on a Phoenix-based radio show that his mathematical analysis of the election results suggested it was impossible for him to have lost and called for an investigation into the race, a concern that Jones also supported on Twitter. Who thinks it's possible that a Democrat in a majority R district during a massive red wave has the ability to get 100% of the Democrat votes, a fairly good share of the Republican votes, and most of the independent votes in an AZ legislative race? Jones tweeted on November 8th. On November 9th, she tweeted a demand for a Justice Department investigation into Pima County's election results. Donald Trump said people would be going to jail this time, Jones wrote. We need the DOJ to investigate Pima County. There's three exclamation points there. Martinez said she did not believe that there was such a scheme afoot to use early ballots to rig the election, but she was looking forward to reviewing the Pima County Recorder's Office's response to her coming public records request. Concerns about jailhouse voter registration drives. In their letter to Mays, Jones and Martinez also said the Cesaris Kelly had essentially facilitated illegal voting through a reckless voter registration inmate program. Cesaris Kelly's office has run voting registration drives at the Pima County Jail. Martinez said she was okay with allowing people who are awaiting trial or serving time in Pima County Jail to register to vote, but she didn't think Cesaris Kelly had significant safeguards in place to avoid allowing felons to register. Certainly, if you are incarcerated and you're a felon, you should not be voting, Martinez said. If you are incarcerated for a DUI, you are not a felon. You should absolutely vote if you choose to. However, we need to have that on lockdown. We need to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all our T's are crossed so that the people who are voting are eligible to vote and able to vote. On a monthly basis, county clerks of the superior courts across Arizona are required by law to deliver lists of those convicted of felonies to the Arizona Secretary of State, who then informs county recorders to remove them from the voting rolls. Martinez said she was concerned that if a county recorder registers someone to vote while they are in jail awaiting trial, they could possibly cast a ballot in between the time they are convicted of a felony and the time their conviction is reported to the county recorder. Martinez said that if a felon votes after losing the right to do so, the felon is the one breaking the law and who would potentially face criminal charges. But she added that they might think they can vote if they registered while awaiting trial in jail. I have found that not everybody has a full understanding of being able to register or not, what you're able to do and what you're not able to do, because there are lots of people who try to register to vote who are not eligible for one reason or another, Martinez said. So I think that we need to do a better job on educating the general public as to who can vote and who cannot vote. People who are incarcerated, I don't know their level of education on the importance of voting. People who are incarcerated are at low point in their lives. Whether it's DUI, whether it's robbery, whether it's drugs, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's murder, they are not at the high point of their life. so they may not be in the right mind of thinking of whether or not they're eligible to vote or not. And that concludes this story. GOP lawmakers call on AZ Attorney General to probe Pima Recorder over 2024 election. Next, we have an update on marijuana sales. Recreational marijuana sales stabilized in October following sharp September drop. By Jim Small, December 9, 2024. Arizona's recreational marijuana market showed signs of stabilization in October, with dispensaries selling $75.3 million in adult-use cannabis products, up from September's $67.3 million, according to the latest data from the Arizona Department of Revenue. The medical marijuana sector continued its long-term decline, with October sales falling to $16.9 million, marking one of the lowest monthly totals since Arizona voters approved recreational sales in 2020. The latest revenue report also included substantial upward revisions to previous month's data. September's recreational sales were adjusted to $74.9 million, an increase of $7.6 million from initial estimates. And March sales were revised up by $3.1 million to $92.5 million, establishing a new peak for monthly recreational sales in 2024. Through October, Arizona's marijuana market has generated more than $1 billion in total sales for 2024, with recreational dispensaries recording approximately $808 million and medical dispensaries logging $204 million. However, the current sales pace suggests the market will fall significantly short of 2023's total sales of $1.4 billion. Even with the projected decline in overall sales, the shifting balance between medical and recreational sales has accelerated in 2024. While medical marijuana represented 21.5% of total sales in January, that share dropped to 17.5% by September. This continues a transformation that began when recreational sales launched in 2021, when medical marijuana, legal in Arizona since 2010, initially dominated the market. Now, recreational sales consistently outpace medical sales by a roughly 4-to-1 margin. Total marijuana tax collections reached $222.1 million through October, including $68.5 million from recreational sales and $136.6 million in excise taxes. Medical marijuana generated an additional $17 million in tax revenue. These figures represent a decline from both 2023 and 2022, when strong sales and a robust medical market drove higher tax collections. The state collects a 16% excise tax on recreational sales in addition to the standard sales tax, while medical patients pay roughly 6% in state sales tax. Local jurisdictions add approximately 2% for all marijuana sales. Tax revenue supports various state programs, with excise tax funds distributed among community colleges, 33%, public safety, 31%, highway projects, 25%, and social services programs, 10%, aimed at communities disproportionately impacted by marijuana criminalization. The Revenue Department notes that recent months' data may be revised as additional tax returns are processed, as demonstrated by the significant adjustments to previously reported figures in the November report. And that's all for this update. Recreational marijuana sales stabilized in October following sharp September drop. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Moving on to the second half of our program, judge tosses GOP lawsuit to purge 1.27 million Arizona voters, by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, December 5th, 2024. A federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit launched by Arizona Republicans claiming that the state is violating federal law by failing to clean up the state's voter registration list, saying there is no legal grounds to sue. Arizona Republican Party Chairwoman Gina Swoboda, Arizona Free Enterprise Club President Scott Musi, and Republican businessman Stephen Gaynor, who unsuccessfully ran to be the state's top elections official in 2018, filed the lawsuit in federal court earlier this year, alleging that Secretary of State Adrian Fontes' inaction violates the National Voter Registration Act. The trio claim that the Democrat has failed to purge over 1 million ineligible and unaccounted-for voters from Arizona's voter registration rolls, diluting their votes as eligible voters and costing the Arizona Republican Party time and resources on voter education and mobilization campaigns. The NVRA directs states to make reasonable efforts to maintain their voter rolls. But in an order issued Thursday, U.S. District Court Judge Dominic Lanza dismissed the lawsuit, siding with Fontes' argument that the Republicans don't have sufficient standing to sue his office. Standing is established when a plaintiff suffers a concrete, specific injury, Lanza wrote, that presents an imminent threat and can be resolved by the court. Filing a lawsuit based on the claim that the government broke the law doesn't constitute standing, and neither does challenging an action that the plaintiff disagrees with, he wrote. A recognizable right needs to have been violated for the court to weigh in on the matter. A citizen does not have standing to challenge a government regulation simply because the plaintiff believes the government is acting illegally, Lanza wrote, citing a U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this year in an abortion case. A citizen may not sue based on an asserted right to have the government act in accordance with law. Nor may citizens sue merely because their legal objection is accompanied by a strong moral, ideological, or policy objection to a government action. In his 19-page ruling, Lanza picked apart the theories presented by the three Republicans as proof that they have standing to sue Fontes, finding them all to be insufficient. In their lawsuit, Musi, Swoboda, and Gaynor alleged that their votes were being unfairly diluted by the vast number of votes potentially cast by ineligible voters. The trio claim that between 500,000 and 1.27 million voters remain on the voter list despite being dead or having moved. Those numbers were drawn from the number of voters who didn't respond when Fontes' office sent out 752,387 voter registration confirmation notices to Maricopa County residents. More than 130,000 were subsequently removed, but the remainder didn't respond and weren't removed from the rolls. The lawsuit also uses 2022 voter registration data and U.S. Census Bureau statistics to argue that Apache, La Paz, Navajo, and Santa Cruz counties have, quote, implausibly high voter registration rates. Lanza wrote that seeking redress based on voter dilution is too hypothetical. The purported injury depends on too many steps to be true, he said. An ineligible person must request an early ballot or show up to vote at the polls. They must then cast a ballot. That ballot must be tabulated by election officials, and there must also be a high enough number of identical cases for the claim of vote dilution to be considered. And the Republicans presented no evidence of that occurring, just speculation that it could happen. On top of that, Lanza noted, the courts have concluded that the tabulation of some invalid votes by itself isn't reason enough to support a claim of vote dilution. Vote dilution hurts everyone equally, meaning that it can't be used by an individual to establish standing to sue because of a personal injury, and there needs to be proof that the invalid votes hurt one group of voters over another. During oral arguments, the attorneys for the Republican plaintiffs disavowed that they were alleging any partisan impact by their claims, conceding their alleged injury was shared equally by all voters. Another theory that a lack of confidence in the system could dissuade the trio from voting in future elections was also dismissed as hypothetical. And choosing not to vote constitutes inflicting injury to themselves rather than suffering it from Fonte's actions, Lanza pointed out. Respondents cannot manufacture standing merely by inflicting harm on themselves based on their fears of hypothetical future harm that is not certainly impending, the judge wrote, citing a 2013 ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. The last argument that Fonte's inefficient voter list maintenance incurred costs for the Arizona Republican Party in its effort to reach out to and mobilize voters was also rejected. Organizations, Lanza said, need to show that a government action impacts them before they use their resources to respond. Choosing to spend money and advocate against a government action that an organization has a grievance against isn't tantamount to a personal injury and doesn't create standing to sue. And there is a copy of this ruling in the article. That concludes this story. Judge tosses GOP lawsuit to purge 1.27 million Arizona voters. And next up, solar power growth in AZ could slow if Trump keeps his promise to kill Biden-era incentives. By Amelia Monroe of Cronkite News, December 10, 2024. The $2 billion Sun Stream complex in western Maricopa County will soon generate enough power to supply over 200,000 homes. The first phase has been transforming Arizona's scalding sunlight into electricity for more than 3 years. The vast solar farm covers more than 6,000 acres, or 9 square miles. By 2026, it will generate 973 megawatts of emission-free electricity and, over time, $300 million in lease payments and taxes to Arizona schools and communities, according to Boston-based Long Road Energy. The projects benefit from the historic Inflation Reduction Act legislation. The IRA is making the economy move, Long Road CEO Paul Gaynor said at the April ribbon cutting. Right here in Arizona, $2 billion of investment, components made in America, competitive carbon-free electricity, and significant job creation. It's a great story. Such stories may not be told much longer because President-elect Donald Trump has promised to kill the IRA, ending subsidies for such projects. The IRA, approved in 2022, is President Joe Biden's signature climate policy. It created tax credits estimated at $370 billion to encourage a shift to solar and wind energy, electric vehicles, and other green projects as a way of cutting greenhouse gas emissions linked to fossil fuels. Goldman Sachs put the value of the incentives at nearly $1.2 trillion by 2032. My plan will terminate the Green New Deal, which I call the Green New Scam, Trump said at the New York Economic Club on September 5th. We will rescind all unspent funds under the misnamed Inflation Reduction Act. Overturning the IRA will take an act of Congress, though. Many of Trump's fellow Republicans represent states that reap big benefits from it, and some have openly vowed defiance if necessary to protect the law. Long Road officials haven't specified how much of the Sunstream complex financing comes from Biden-era incentives. They declined to comment on the impacts if Trump cuts off funding under the IRA, which is designed both to address climate change and spur targeted U.S. industries. The complex, about 40 miles west of Phoenix, is projected to offset about 1.3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions. Long Road boasts a partnership with Phoenix-based First Solar, the biggest U.S. maker of solar panels. China dominates the solar panel market, accounting for 80% of global sales. U.S. officials have long accused China of unfair trade practices, keeping prices artificially low to kill off competitors, and have used tariffs to offset such practices. In May, the Biden administration said it would double tariffs on Chinese solar panels from 25% to 50%. At the ribbon cutting, Governor Katie Hobbs called the Sunstream Complex a powerful example of how responsible land stewardship and the ambitious expansion of renewable energy infrastructure delivers a wealth of benefits to Arizona citizens. Since 2010, industrial-scale solar installations costs have dropped more than 40%. That has fueled a decade of spectacular growth, averaging 25% per year, according to the Solar Energy Industries Association, SEIA. Clean wind and solar energy are cheaper than ever and are getting cheaper each year, said Ellen Montgomery, Public Lands Campaign Director at Environment America, an activist group. About 11% of electricity in Arizona comes from solar. The state ranks fifth in total solar capacity, according to the SEIA, which projects that Arizona will add 12 gigawatts of solar generating capacity in the next 5 years, more than doubling the current 8 gigawatts and enough to power 1.4 million homes. An analysis from the Net Zero Industrial Policy Lab at Johns Hopkins University found that repealing the IRA would harm U.S. manufacturing, costing jobs and tax revenue, and cutting exports by up to $50 billion. The growing U.S. battery industry relies heavily on federal subsidies, the policy lab said. If the goal is to have more domestic manufacturing, to be, quote, America first, and to focus on more of the energy types that we have here, then the IRA is essential, said Autumn Johnson, the Arizona executive director at SEIA. Otherwise, there is very little reason for companies to move their manufacturing back to the United States. Democrats controlled Congress when the IRA was approved. All Republicans opposed it. The House approved it 220 to 207. In the Senate, Vice President Kamala Harris provided the tie-breaking vote. Republicans will control both chambers starting January 3rd, giving Trump broad latitude for his agenda. But repealing the IRA will be a challenge. In the Senate, where it takes 60 votes to move legislation, Democrats have enough seats to block any such measure. And many Republicans also embrace the law. In August, 18 House Republicans, including Representative Juan Ciscomani of Tucson, wrote Speaker Mike Johnson urging against repeal of the IRA. They called the legislation flawed, but wrote, "We hear from industry and our constituents who fear the energy tax regime will once again be turned on its head due to Republican repeal efforts. Prematurely repealing energy tax credits, particularly those which were used to justify investments that already broke ground, would undermine private investments and stop development that is already ongoing," they warned. The, quote, worst-case scenario, they argued, would be cutting off funds for projects already underway that already received federal subsidies. Energy tax credits have spurred innovation, incentivized investment, and created good jobs in many parts of the country, including many districts represented by members of our conference, Ciscomani and the others told the speaker. On November 25th, Trump announced that he intends to impose 25% tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico and 35% on imports from China to pressure these countries to halt illegal immigration and drug smuggling. The tariffs on Chinese solar panels are already higher than that, though solar industry officials said across-the-board tariffs would drive up costs on other necessary components. Tariffs on solar panels have steered U.S. buyers to other suppliers, and imports continue to rise, rising nearly 14% in the first quarter of 2024 to 14.8 gigawatts, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence Global Trade Analytics Suite. That was just shy of the quarterly record. Nearly 90% of those panels came from Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, and Cambodia, where some Chinese companies have moved operations to dodge U.S. tariffs. On November 29th, Biden administration trade officials announced tariffs as high as 271% on solar panels from Chinese companies with factories in those countries. First Solar was among the U.S. companies that brought the complaint that led to the latest round of tariffs. Johnson, the solar industry executive, said IRA repeal would undermine the point of tariffs on Chinese solar panels and components. Both the IRA and tariffs are meant to encourage domestic production. For 30 years, they've been pushing globalization and an international supply chain, she said. It's become in vogue now to be protectionist and have a domestic supply chain. But building that supply chain takes time and ongoing incentives, she said, adding, you don't step up an entire manufacturing ecosystem in 2 years. It's just not possible. And that concludes this story. Solar panel growth in AZ could slow if Trump keeps his promise to kill Biden-era incentives. Next up, Biden launched a national plan for Indigenous language protection and revitalization by Sean Dean Silversmith, December 9, 2024. To support the revitalization, protection, preservation, and reclamation of Indigenous languages across the United States, the Biden-Harris administration released a 10-year national plan on Native revitalization during the 2024 White House Tribal Nations Summit. Indigenous languages are central to our cultures, our lifeways, and who we are as people, Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland said in a press release. They connect us to our ancestors, to our homelands, and to our place in the world. The national plan is a joint effort between government agencies that outline strategies to help address the government's role in the loss of Indigenous languages among Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander communities. This ambitious plan represents the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to address the wrongs of the past and restore what has been taken from us, Haaland said. The Departments of the Interior, Education, and Health and Human Services produced the plan. The National Plan on Native Language Revitalization is the result of the Department of Interior's work to address the systematic and deliberate policies set in place by the United States to forcibly assimilate Indigenous peoples and eradicate Indigenous languages and cultures as part of the federal Indian boarding school system. Congressional authorities and funding of this plan will reduce the number of vulnerable and endangered Native languages and increase the number of proficient Native language speakers, as defined by Native Americans, according to the report. The Department of Interior launched the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative in 2021. The initiative released two reports that highlighted the devastating impact the boarding school system had and continues to have on Indigenous communities. It also provided a complete list of all federally operated schools. President Joe Biden became the first sitting president to formally acknowledge and apologize to Indigenous communities in October for the federal government's role in developing and enforcing the policies. The legacy of forced assimilation continues to threaten the existence of many Native languages, and the legacy of the boarding school era echoes in today's educational experience for Native students, according to the report. The report states that congressional action is required to preserve Indigenous languages. If action is not taken, fewer than 20 Indigenous languages will still be used in America by 2050. There are 167 Indigenous languages currently spoken. We use language to write history, share knowledge, map the future, and pass down traditions. Secretary of Health and Human Services Javier Becerra said in a written statement, "Investing in language revitalization strengthens communities and contributes to their resiliency." The plan prioritizes investing in and supporting indigenous language efforts within academia. The plan calls for strategic investments in core content instruction in indigenous languages to improve the educational outcomes for all indigenous youth. I always say multilingualism is a superpower, and that includes Native American languages, Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona said. Cardona said he traveled through Indian country as Secretary of Education and learned words in the Oneida, Dakota, and Nakota languages. One thing was crystal clear. When young people reclaim their native languages, they reconnect deeply with who they are and where they come from, he said. But Native peoples have suffered from shameful policies that aim to eradicate these languages and cultures for too long. Cardona added that he is hopeful that this national plan will be the start of the government's remediation for its participation in federal Indian boarding school policies that have impacted indigenous communities for generations. I am hopeful we can all choose to keep fighting for a future where Native communities have the tools and support to keep their languages alive and their cultures thriving, he said. According to the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Indian Education, BIE, funds 187 schools for Indigenous students and works to provide them with a culturally relevant, high-quality education. However, the BIE did not receive funding for language revitalization until 2017, and the appropriations have not exceeded $7.5 million for any year. As part of the summit, the Department of Interior also announced a cooperative agreement with the National Fund for Excellence in American Indian Education, which will provide $7.5 million in existing grant funding to BIE schools supporting the launch or expansion of immersion programs. This funding will help build a network of BIE schools committed to integrating Native language immersion and cultural education into their curricula, offering students the tools to connect with their language and heritage, the department stated in a press release. Together with the National Plan for Native Language Revitalization, these efforts create a comprehensive strategy to protect, preserve, and reclaim indigenous languages across the United States. And that concludes this story. Biden launched a national plan for indigenous language protection and revitalization. And finally, we have an update on a story we've been hearing a lot about in Arizona. Judges in Oregon, Washington block Kroger-Albertson supermarket merger, by Julia Shumway of Oregon Capital Chronicle, December 10, 2024. Judges in Oregon and Washington on Tuesday blocked supermarket giants Kroger and Albertsons from merging, throwing into question the future of the $24.6 billion largest proposed grocery merger in U.S. history. U.S. District Court Judge Adrienne Nelson in Portland temporarily halted the merger, writing in her 71-page ruling in a lawsuit against the merger led by federal regulators that it would lead to undue market concentration, reduce competition, and hurt customers. Her preliminary injunction paused the $24.6 billion proposed merger while the Federal Trade Commission's administrative judge continues its review of implications. King County Superior Court Judge Marshall Ferguson in Seattle also ruled that the merger could not move forward in Washington in a separate case, stating that the proposed merger violated state antitrust laws. Another state lawsuit is pending in Colorado. The rulings mean Kroger's 2022 proposal to buy Albertsons is on hold while the companies decide whether to proceed. If they do, an in-house administrative judge at the Federal Trade Commission will determine whether the merger is anti-competitive, though a Kroger lawsuit seeks to block that review. The FTC, joined by several states, including Oregon, sued in February to block the merger, saying it would eliminate competition, drive up costs, and lead to lower quality products and services. Henry Liu, director of the FTC's Bureau of Competition, said in a statement that Tuesday's ruling will protect Americans who buy groceries and work at grocery stores. This historic win protects millions of Americans across the country from higher prices for essential groceries, from milk to bread to eggs, ultimately allowing consumers to keep more money in their pockets, Liu said. This victory has a direct, tangible impact on the lives of millions of Americans who shop at Kroger or Albertsons' own grocery stores for their everyday needs, whether that's a Fry's in Arizona, a Vons in Southern California, or a Jewel Osco in Illinois. And we'll note here that Fry's is related to Kroger and Albertsons related to Safeway, so these do have a direct impact on people in Arizona. Albertsons, which merged with Safeway in 2015, is the nation's second largest grocery chain with about 285,000 employees and nearly 2,270 stores across the country. And that's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you every week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. If you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on Demand Podcasts. And you know you can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. And you can also take Sun Sounds with you by getting our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week, and stay tuned for more great programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona.